From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hey, what's going on? It's me, Rad, and you are listening to another awesome episode of Soft Rep Radio. But before I get into my next guest today, who you can already see on the screen if you're watching on the YouTubes, is I want to talk to you about my merch store, okay? We have a merch store for Soft Rep. It helps keep the lights on. A little bit goes a long way for us. I love doing this show, and I really appreciate Brandon and everybody, you know, keeping the merch store open. So go support that. And then also, we have a book club. It's softrep.com/book-club. Go check it out. Get involved. If you want to learn about some books that we talk about to the authors, you can get into the book club. Brandon Webb's books are in there. John David Mann. Hopefully we can get my next guest, Robert Spangle of 1,000 Yard Style, and his book into our book club. And let's welcome him to our show. Welcome, Robert.
Well, very, very happy to be here and very honored. So thanks for having me, Rad.
Well, you know, today's special guest, kids, is Robert Spangle, and he's a photographer, and he's a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. Can you tell us a little bit about the Marine Corps and what you, how old were you when you enlisted? Kind of the timeline of, I went through boot camp, then I got into this other thing, and then I went here.
Oh boy, that whole blur.
It doesn't have to be that big though. You can just get right to it.
So I joined in 2017, got out in 2011. I signed up when I was 17 and a half. My parents like signed off on me, so I left right after high school. Basically, this is still kind of like the pre-internet military. You know, the internet existed, but social media and all that stuff wasn't really there. And the whole structure of the military wasn't online and transparent. I wanted to go infantry. I was told that I should go recon because I was good at swimming. So I went recon. That was like after boot camp and infantry school, that was like a five, six month training cycle. It was pretty arduous and familiar to many people. I wound up getting sent to 2nd Recon Battalion. And this is a interesting period in the battalion's history and also in Force Recon history. Force Recon had essentially been dissolved, I think, about 3 years before. You had DET-1 guys who'd kind of like gone away and then set up like MSOB, right? So Force Recon hadn't functionally existed for a few years, and they were looking at standing it back up. to have it as a new asset, as an asset that was deployable to battle space of those days, which was Iraq and Afghanistan.
And a MEU, is that a Marine Expeditionary Unit?
MEU, it is.
Is that what you just referenced?
Yeah,
right,
which
there?
Is a, yeah, which is a nice acronym for sitting on a boat waiting for something bad to happen. So I got really lucky in that I got roped into a very, very senior position, which was Force Recon, literally getting off the bus when I got to Camp Lejeune. Basically, everyone else at that platoon, and it was just a platoon when we started, it wasn't really a fully fledged company for, I think, a full year afterwards, was guys who had, you know, 2-3 combat deployments, either recon guys or recon guys and scout snipers, super experienced dudes. And I got really lucky that I got kind of thrown into the ring with them because they needed the numbers. You know, this was a time where we had Iraq and Afghanistan going on full tilt. There was casualties and there was a lot of demand for senior guys getting pulled into MSOB, MSOC, that kind of thing. So I got the best run you could ever have in the military, which was going into an extremely senior unit as an extremely junior Marine. I was the youngest, lowest ranking guy when I got in. I was the youngest, lowest ranking guy when I got out. And the time in between is pretty good. So that was my military experience.
Can you tell me what MSOV stands? MSOV, is that what you're referencing?
Right, there's MSOC and then there's MSOB. So Marine Special Operations Battalion. That was, I'm not going to get the exact years right. I don't want someone who's in the unit to like tear my ears off, but...
Comment down below.
Yeah. You know, the Marine Corps historically has been very anti-special forces, right? And very kind of like anti-special. Force Recon had historically been the Marine Corps equivalent of the special forces. When the special forces were stood up by Kennedy, it was Marine Force Recon primarily, and then UDTs, which became SEALs secondarily. And the Marine Corps took a path of not wanting to centralize with special forces, and the rest of the armed forces went for like SOCOM centralization and a kind of an independent structure from their own branch. And I think most people would say that the Marine Corps really suffered from that. So 2001, 2002, 2003, you had DET 1, which is essentially Force Recon, was the Marine Corps' direct action and reconnaissance, deep reconnaissance asset. They were functioning as like true special forces, right? And getting tasked out, but Marine Corps was like really missing out on the action because they weren't part of SOCOM. Mm-hmm. As I remember it, DET 1 winds up getting dissolved, and basically a lot of those guys get pulled into other branches of the special forces, agencies, things like that, right? And Force Recon really never comes back in full strength. The Marine Corps eventually kind of throws in the towel and says, we want to be part of the special forces, and they stand up MSOB and MSOC, right? Which becomes a streamlined special forces that's part of and answerable to SOCOM.
So now they're attached to a SOCOM mothership,
right?
Even though they're MARSOC, they still can get the support they need through SOCOM, right? They probably want that.
Well,
any asset from SOCOM.
Right. And as I understand it, like, you know, their support was much better, right? But also their tasking was wider. So in the past, one of the reasons the Marine Corps never wanted to go for special forces was they didn't want their best men being pulled away from the Marine Corps, right? Answering to Army, Air Force, even like larger scale national needs. And that's kind of the trade-off with going into SOCOM. So that was kind of like the change of roles that occurred. And I got very lucky in landing in this weird transitory period where Force Recon was getting stood back up and wasn't really redefined yet. And then MSOB was like more or less like getting its feet and kind of like already operating. By the time I was on my first deployment in Afghanistan, those guys had already been on the ground there doing their thing exceptionally well for a very long time.
Now, are you as hardcore as donning face paint when you would go on your mission?
I think different teams had like different debates about that. We took camouflage very, very seriously. I think like the reconnaissance role, if you're really into it, you have to be extremely humble about it. And these illusions that like 6 or 7 guys are going to hold off several hundred that's a worst case scenario that you do everything within your power to mitigate and avoid. So we took camouflage like very, very seriously. Everyone would like cami up before missions. Some people would take this like more seriously than others. You know, all of our personal equipment is going to be like camouflaged. Guys would like really pay attention to like what they were eating, like dipping, smoking, like days and weeks prior before a mission, just to try to camouflage the way we smelled from locals, right? Mm-hmm. So it's taken,
yeah,
that part was taken like really, really seriously from lessons learned. And, you know, now going back into like dog history, you understand where these lessons started. And in Afghanistan, I deployed twice there with Force Recon. You saw that almost all these lessons are still valid, and we had opportunities to kind of improve on these things, right? Like the smell thing, that might not have been that was something that was relevant in Vietnam, right? Because the
right.
North Vietnamese would use dog teams to track teams occasionally, right? We never had that in Afghanistan in terms of dogs, but what we did have a huge problem with was shepherds. And it was our theory that, like, you know, goats, sheep, whatever, like they're just kind of, you know, grazing around or whatever. Dogs. But if they smell something weird, they're going to migrate towards it, right? Especially if it, you know, smells like American laundry detergent and food. So, sure. A little history lesson there.
The reason why I bring that up is because you have some style. I want to just mention your Instagram. Is that cool with your 1,000-yard style?
It.
You know, it's a blue check mark for those of you that really need to know, right? It's legit. And it's got a lot of cool photography. And Robert's also a fashion designer from his experience in the military. He's just brought to him he's brought to his unique style to his bags. Those sea bags that you make that you've invested your energy into that have like the ability to put like a sleeping bag or a mat on the bottom of it when you want to tote it, and you know how you have it to blend in. That's why I brought up your camouflage on your face, because you're basically doing that with that bag. You got all these guys out there that are like, we're this gray man.
Right.
Okay. And I can still spot that, right? I'm like, I just am going to wear camouflage, bro. But honestly, you're going to like places where it's not friendly towards you sometimes. You just, I believe, got back from Ukraine, right? You've been over there for a minute doing some. Yeah. And you got to blend in. Did you have to blend in? That's why I was wondering, you know, you got to just kind of like.
I mean, I think the idea of camouflage is as important as it is like misunderstood. Right. It's interesting for me that I've ended up in other careers post-military where camouflage was still relevant and still important.
Right.
I spend about like half the year now working as a photojournalist. And, you know, to your point about the whole sort of gray man thing, the gray man doctrine was kind of what we were taught going through the schoolhouse and was really like kind of beaten into us in the reconnaissance community. This idea that, you know, don't be first, don't be last, don't ever let them know your name. Right. Like to blend in, to be a part of the crowd, not to stick out, but not to kind of like profile yourself. But that in and of itself has become a uniform that anyone who is in that arena, be it, you know, military or intelligence, can pick up on instantly, right? So now it's not really, that's not really effective camouflage anymore.
It's not really gray. Yeah.
But to your question, since my military experience, you know, I spent a considerable amount of time in Afghanistan, even more time in Ukraine, a little bit in Iraq, a lot of time just like in kind of places that were a little bit tense overseas.
Hostile?
Some hostile, some not. Like Lebanon's Lebanon's a good example, right? Like I went to Lebanon in, I think, 2016 with a wonderful French woman I was dating at the time. And for her, it was very much a vacation. And for me, I'm like, this is Hezbollah territory.
Yep.
And you come to understand the world is made up a lot of these places where like little neighborhood borders can go from a place where everything is kind of normal and tactile and understood to you to being extremely foreign and potentially dangerous. But camouflage being a part of that, like as a journalist or, you know, whatever, traveling abroad, you have to pay attention and kind of like do what you can to mitigate your signature and kind of communicate as little as possible to, you know, the people around you, right? Information is always very easily weaponized. And there's a flip side to that too, which is like the more that you pay attention to culture and the way people dress, it's also easier for you to understand the people around you, right? You know, I remember seeing you at SHOT Show with like the NAMM boots and the tiger stripe pants, right? And like, obviously in SHOT Show, that's not the craziest thing, right? But to me, I was like right away, I was like, oh, like, this guy's got some Vietnam vibes, right? Like I can go up to him and we can talk about, you know, X, Y, and Z.
Oh yeah. And we did.
And everywhere else I've been in the world, some kind of that like local specialized knowledge has paid off. So many times in Ukraine, because like I'm a little bit of a gear queer, right? Like I know I'm not like as into it as I used to be, but like I can talk about the different tactical brands and I can recognize them, right? Sort of like a little bit of tuned lingo. that makes it really easy to talk to like the higher tier and like younger Ukrainian soldiers that are out there. The older set of guys who are kind of from the very Soviet style military, right? Like guys whose career started before the Maidan Revolution. They're not really like, they're part of a different system. The younger guys, like you can see them with their cry stuff or Roman
blade
stuff, right? And you can go up to them and talk to them about it, right? And that establishes like a level of trust that like they understand that you understand. And maybe they're a little bit less suspicious of you being a journalist who's there to like throw them underneath the bus, right? Because like you talk the lingo. That's an easy comparison. And like a kind of more difficult one would be like Afghanistan, huge language barrier. You're trying to kind of make rapport with people who are totally from a different culture and don't have a shared language. But even with that, like there's a kind of universal respect for style, right? And it is like, it's not language based. Like you don't need to have any shared language to be able to communicate that like, oh dude, like you've got style, right?
Like I like your glasses.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and
some dude, you're like, oh, your glasses, those are cool.
Yeah. And like, you know, I spent a little time there and you kind of come to understand that before the Taliban took over the country, right? Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was a Mujahideen leader, right? Was sort of the style icon of everyone who was not in support of the Taliban, right? And if you could like look at him, you'd see it reflected in the way like military guys dressed, older guys have been Mujahideen. And if you started to kind of like emulate that a little bit, you know, like look at the way this guy's dressed, look at the colors he wore, right? Look at the way he like wore his peckle hat and his field jacket. And you can kind of do that thing yourself. People would sort of intuitively pick up that like, okay, this guy knows his history a little bit. He knows what's going on culturally a little bit, right? And you're just kind of, you're going to have more familiar and friendly ground with someone automatically.
Oh yeah, the Pakul hat is a Pakul story, bro. Yeah. It's a pretty Pakul hat you got there, bro. I love it, dude. I love it. And it's got also multiple, like you could put grain in it to feed the horses, and it could be like a carrier, and it also can roll up and go onto their head.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's just multiple purpose. Yeah. And if you go over there, if you knew that, that would probably go, oh.
Well, and the,
you know,
if you understand the history of it, right, and you go to the different regions where it's more or less predominant, right, you can read so much into that. So the peckle hut originally came in like the 13th century, and it was brought by the Greeks.
Wow.
So this is what Alexander the Great's men were like wearing. It wasn't even Greek. It was Italian, right? They pretty sure it came from Florence, right? And if you go to Florence and you see like their kind of historical reenactment today, you can see a similar thing just done in a slightly different way. And when this hat arrived in Afghanistan, it was really only in a province called Nuristan. Nuristan is super remote. It's known for being like wild and inconquerable. They only converted to Islam about 110 years ago. And it is tangentially directly next to Panjshir, right? So it makes sense since Panjshir was kind of a concentration of the Mujahideen, right? And Nuristan would be their kind of rat line corridor to Pakistan for arms or X, Y, and Z, that the Panjshiris would start wearing the peckle hat, right? As such, the peckle hat became a symbol, but of like the Northern Alliance of the anti-Taliban resistance in the country. So up until the, you know, democratic government came into being, the peckle hat was worn by like very few people. It was a very kind of, it was very limited to those kinds of districts, right? And it was like very political. And with the democratic government and their kind of 20-year existence, right, it became more and more popular. More provinces start putting their spin on it, right? And it stays that way until the Taliban takes over the country, right? And the interesting thing is the Taliban, who are very controlling over what people wear, obviously, they didn't ban the peckle hat, but they wear a very specific style. So like they put their spin on it. Rather than,
is it the way it's rolled so tight on the top of their head, and then there's like,
and it cuts off the circulation to your brain.
yeah. Like it's super tight rolled. It's almost like a beret.
That is much more of like
Northern,
style, right? That's more like the Mujahideen style. What the Taliban guys that I've photographed and saw and met, like what they wear is larger. It's like almost like Rastafarian. Like it's larger, poofier. They have like more hair, I guess. I don't know. It's just like, it's like a larger, like bigger thing, right? And some of these guys put their like shadada pins on there, but it's like a much larger, bigger thing. And it has a kind of like,
I think I've seen that.
embroidery on the top. It's a totally different thing, but that's something that you didn't really see in the past that you see now. And for me, that's one of the reasons that like fashion is an interesting way to analyze conflict, like the cultural aspect of conflict, right? It's easier for us to be like, oh, ERDL is like super sick and I love Tiger Stripe, but the psychology behind those decisions and how they come into prominence, right? That to me is like fascinating.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Right, like, where did Tiger Stripe, why was it even created? Why was the South Vietnamese advisors wearing it? Why did the U.S. Right. start to adopt
well,
it?
How did he go,
you know, and run with it?
How did it become, like, a punk rock staple, right? That wasn't just, right. like, it was...
Well, because the 70s, forever, the 60s, but, the 70s, Surplus. Right. Yeah, Surplus.
It was, well, it was Surplus, but it was also Joe Strummer, right? So, like, I couldn't tell you which one came first, right? But, like, punk guys are all wearing Surplus, right? And they love, like... They love subverting boots. Uniforms and things like that. But Joe Strummer is obsessed with Vietnam, right? And he's obsessed with Vietnam photographers. He wrote, you know, he wrote at least one song about Sean Flynn. And it was something he researched quite a lot. And I think like became part of his psychology. So like, I don't know if he started wearing the stuff because it was available and then that made him research things. Or if he was like researching things and then he got into the uniforms. I don't know. But... the psychology of that is crazy, right? Like we go from something that is very much a part of like the state uniform doing things that are, you know, borderline illegal and deniable in other countries, right? To what punk rockers are making iconic on stages around the world. It's
and Joel Strummer, he's the Clash and Big Audio Dynamite, right? For those of us that are listening that may not know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But for, I mean, we could just say the Clash, right?
The Clash. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had to say Big Audio Dynamite. Yeah, I had to give him his credit. I had that cassette. You know, when you say that, it's just like, yeah, I, again, you know, the whole thing about Tiger Stripe having gold or having different types of green, you know, and just like all these different, I love Tiger Stripe. I love Tiger, like the orange and black stripes.
Yeah. Well, and that, even
let
that.
Alone, like all the subdued versions.
This is a, you know, this is a, it's an imitation of nature. Right, that came from this specific place that we were thinking about, right? And you know, most Tiger Stripe was made in, well, quite a lot of it was like made in Japan, right? And that was because of their post-war economy. It's like all these things are tied together, and it's a single thread that you can kind of pick up and really trace the social and cultural influence on a lot of different sides of any, you know, of any conflict. So I think that's, to me, like that's something my mind is preoccupied with way too much, probably.
Very hard for me, 6'5", 280, to find Vietnam gear that fits me, bro. Where's that big Marine that was swinging around a tree? Where's he at? I need his used gear.
Unfortunately, I don't think he lasted very long, right?
No. He just swung that tree a few times. Big
They're
Marine.
Probably like, oh, you big high-profile guy. We're going to have you carry the radio and the machine gun.
Yeah, exactly, right? And go in the tunnel. You're going in the tunnel. Rad, get in there. Take a flashlight. Oh, man. Yeah, I'm a big boy.
It's good for me because like I'm on the smaller side, so basically everything fits me, but there is that surplus economy, and it does tend to be that like American dudes are always like really big and like bulked out, right? And like the locals are not so much. The two trips I did as a journalist to Afghanistan, which is photojournalist or photographer, in 2021 and the end of 2022, I actually went through Kabul and a couple other places looking for military vintage just because I'm interested in it and I want to see like what is this shaking out as.
They got some ACUs in their thrift store.
Like tons of ACUs. Also interesting that you would see like there were so many nations involved with ISAF. You were seeing,
Flecktarn,
ACUs, Marine stuff, tons of British stuff, French stuff,
DPM,
Greek and Australian stuff. And it's all just kind of there. And like you could kind of tell a lot of this stuff had been left behind or traded or given away or stolen or like who knows. But I'd frequently find blouses that were like larges or XLs, right? And had been extremely tailored to become like a size small. And it was kind of interesting because like, it tends to be the special forces guys, right? Who are working with indigenous forces as like force multipliers, right? These dudes, they're all cycled out. They're in great shape, right? They're really at like the top. All these dudes are like heavyweights and fucking
peak performers, right? 100%.
Yeah, and then the local guys, like, they're Afghans. They weigh like 115, 120 pounds, right? Yeah. So you could see kind of this whole, there's this like very worn out special forces uniform, and it's obviously been tailored down like two or three sizes smaller than it was meant to be. And like, what was the story there, right? Like, was did this come from, one of the team leaders who had really like won admiration and respect with the platoon or company that he was training up, and he like left uniforms behind for them? And they continue to wear that. Right. And then now it's been, cast off because these guys are in hiding. That's highly imaginative narrative, but going through these piles of old clothes.
I would imagine Iraq has a very big thrift store too, right? When, we went over there and said that the Ba'ath Party were a terrorist organization and the military was fired. They dropped their uniforms and took their guns.
Yeah.
They got a pink slip.
Yeah.
Here's your uniform. They took off all their gear and said, okay, fine. Yeah. Keep my AK though.
Yeah.
And, where's all that gear? I've got an Iraqi helmet at my store, and I'm like, this is what they put on their head for protection in their mind.
It's just like your pot.
It's like, it's almost like yellow, like a yellow faded. It's like the color of my mug right here, this yellow. And it's just like, fiberglass. It sits domed on top of my, man. Yeah, it's like fiberglass. Thank you. That's the word. Yes, yes.
Yeah, some of the old, what else is like that? Old airborne helmet liners from World War II and a little bit after were like that. They had their steel helmets and then they had like fiberglass helmet liners on the inside that was like to reduce concussions.
That on the head from the metal.
But it is kind of...
That's basically,
It's pretty crazy to see like what happens when you have a very, very modern proven military encounter, something that has not, a military force that has not really been in a conflict or been able to modernize in a long time. There was quite a lot of that in like the first trip I did to Ukraine during the renewed invasion. I was there for like 3 months, kind of the onset of the invasion. And you were looking around and like really seeing, okay, what does it look like when a society suddenly has basically an unrestricted war sprung upon it. And you're seeing, like a vast majority of the population arm themselves and dig in and prepare defenses when they have no real comprehension of this and no real military experience. And then on the side of the guys who've been in the military already for a while and do have experience, they mostly have like a kind of inherited Soviet way of doing things, be it equipment and tactics. And that's really, it really made me appreciate like the training I got in the Marines, the equipment we had, because some of it was just like shocking. I was seeing, guys train on weapon systems that were from like 1926, right? Yeah. Like top drum loaded I don't remember the designator for this weapon.
But let's be clear. The guys training on it are like an old boy band that's now turned combat unit because their life where they were in theater and singing on records has been uprooted in Ukraine. Yeah. And now they're going from the stage to the trenches, training on some 1930s device to try to defend their right to sing.
Yeah.
I was watching those guys do that.
No, and that's really accurate. You had, and this was like the first, 2 weeks of the war, especially like
three.
Mm-hmm. You had really old guys who were like in their 50s or 60s and had some kind of, been conscripted at some point, right? Training really, really, really young people, 18, 19, 20, whose, comprehension of conflict was like playing Call of Duty probably, and trying to train them like, so in 2 or 3 days, they could be dug in somewhere, hopefully establishing like a base of fire. And that was pretty wild because on one hand, you have like the guys with experience have experience from another war, another time. And you're also seeing that the same mindset and strategy and training absolutely fail the Russians in modern conflict. So you're like, oh, this doesn't work out so well. And the other side, you're seeing, kids, very, very young people who are enthusiastic and upbeat, but don't really know what they're getting into and don't have any prior experience, right? That was pretty eye-opening. And I think it was one of those things where I took a few steps back and was like, for all the complaints I had in the Marine Corps, we had it pretty good. We're very well trained, very well equipped. We just needed a little bit of perspective.
Are you saying thank you, drill sergeant?
Yeah. And I mean, also like just, the American taxpayer, right? Like if you look at the amount of logistical support anyone on the ground got in Afghanistan or Iraq, it's really impressive, right? Like the amount of aircraft you had on call overhead, the hundreds of hours of training you had, the research that went into all the equipment you had, your units in parallel that could come at a moment's aid. You were almost always under some kind of supporting fire versus what Ukraine looks like now. Totally different thing.
Yeah, you were there for how many months from February 24th of 2022 is the day of infamy for that situation is how I look at it. I feel that day's powerful like 9/11 was, and we have not fully grasped that as a world yet, where we've lost so many lives due to that invasion and the atrocities that are happening in Ukraine from February's unprovoked attack is no different than the way that we felt on 9/11. We should have that same vibe to, I don't know. That's just me.
One of the interesting things has been that first trip, which was, I was there, I think March 3rd, I got there. There for a little bit over 3 months. That first trip. And to be honest, I didn't know a lot about Ukraine or Ukrainians prior to that trip. I'd been there once for a fashion week in 2017, I think. But I hadn't really learned anything on that trip. I was just doing a job and that was it.
That was normal, right? Normal day, tea, coffee.
Totally normal. And it was in the middle of winter. And I just you were just kind of filing your stories and getting on with it. But talking to Ukrainians, I kind of expected this post 9/11 feeling. Like the way America was, where everyone got super patriotic and were really resolved against, an enemy. And a lot of that was there. The country was extremely resolved, extremely patriotic. People were actually in very, very high spirits, even though they were facing, an imminent ongoing invasion. Mm-hmm. But the difference was you didn't really feel like there was a deep-seated animosity against Russians as a whole, right? People constantly told me in those first 3 months, they're like, I would say where does this war end for you? Do you guys go to the Kerch Bridge? Do you guys go across Crimea? Do you go to all the way to the border of Russia? Do you go to Moscow? Right? Like trying to find out how this plays out in people's heads. And they'd say no, we want all of Ukraine back and free, but the Russians until the 24th were our brothers and we welcomed them into Ukraine. We have a lot of shared history. There wasn't this deep seated hatred against Russians, even as the war progressed, which really kind of that surprised me. And that was a difference. Another difference would be yes, this is very much a 9/11 event where the ripples are going to be felt for generations across history. But the difference is, what if 9/11 was carried out by Canada? It's much more it would be much more immediate, right? Immediate and kind of ongoing. So there's a little bit of a difference there. That was my first sort of 3 months. I think it was a little bit over 3 months in Ukraine. I went back for December to do a Christmas embed this past Christmas. And then I went back again in, it was May and a little bit.
Of 2023? Yeah. Just recently?
Yeah. Did that. It looked like the offensive was kicking off then. So I went back and worked on another story. And I will probably go back here in a few weeks. I'd like to be back there a little bit before September. Because now the counteroffensive really is in full swing. And I would like to be able to tell some of those stories.
Yeah, you know, how do you feel about them trying to telegraph that counteroffensive or any offensive from, you know, everybody's trying to like say today's the right day? I mean,
I got to say, like that, you know, it worked because I say it worked because I totally miscalculated when it was going to happen. One of the things that I really come to admire about the Ukrainians, especially in opposition to the Russians, is they are exceptionally applied and really, really intelligent and like crafty. Mm-hmm. I guess we're at a good point in the war if we have to remind people this, but like they are the underdogs. They're outnumbered and outgunned in all ways. And what they've really leaned into is this kind of Ukrainian like entrepreneurial spirit and this craftiness. So anything that comes out of the Ukrainian government and all of the military actions are like very highly orchestrated and kind of thought out. I honestly couldn't tell you or even offer you an opinion whether this offensive was meant to be a small, piecemeal, very kind of orchestrated and offensive, right? And the idea that this was going to be like a massive blitz that occurred in spring, because they kept calling it the spring offensive, right? I couldn't tell you whether that was tactics that were there deliberately to distract and disinform, or just sort of how things have played out. I do know that the Ukrainians they place a high premium on human life, and they will not commit to tactics where they're losing tons and tons of guys every single day. They can't afford it. And also I think it's a moral departure for them from the Russians. They're highly adaptable as well. So I think if the blitz thing wasn't working out, they would realize that in a day or two and really, you know, reconsider what they were doing.
Shift.
But it was my impression in May when I was there that the groundwork for the offensive was not completely laid yet. I kept saying spring offensive, but looking at troop movements, talking to troops who were coming in and out of the east, especially and towards Zaporizhia, it did not seem like everything had been positioned yet for that offensive. And towards the last few days I was there, you could really pick up a sort of groundswell of ground movement. You were hearing about kind of troops gathering in sort of strategic places that are outside of large cities. So I sort of got the feeling that like the idea of a spring offensive was a little bit of disinformation, right? Mm-hmm. And they had to have known for at least like 1 month that the invasion was not going to be happening, or the counteroffensive was not going to be happening anytime in spring. But, you know, that's me, my impression on the ground. I do not have like the 50,000 foot view on this. And I'm also one guy out there generally working with a fixer and nobody else. I don't have like the resources or essay of someone working at like the New York Times or the Washington Post.
No, you're just, you're in it and you're doing it. And it's a passion that you hold within you to do these stories. And you know, your travels have created you to what? I mean, like when you fell in love with camouflage to be this designer, you are in love. I fell in love with camouflage at a very young age, probably like 4.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You're still learning colors.
I had a little jacket.
Point. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I had a jacket and my dad gave me like a good conduct ribbon on it and it was camouflage. And I started to earn little rad awards around the house. Oh, and my dad would, you know, hey, here you go, Aaron, you know, here's your jump wings. I jump off picnic tables with them and stuff as they get ready. And always want to go in their rucksacks. So I'd say around 4 or 5 is when camouflage became my favorite color.
Yeah. That's a great soundbite right there. It's, you know, that's interesting because like I didn't come from a military family at all. My parents were horrified I joined the military. I had one grandfather who was in the Navy in World War II, just like basically everyone else. Didn't grow up really liking camouflage. I was interested in the military a little bit, but I didn't really play video games or any of this other stuff. Getting out of the military, I was also not interested in camouflage because I was like, I just came from that. And like, I thought multicam was cool. I really thought multicam was cool because I'd had to fight really hard to get that kit for our unit. So I was like personally attached to it. But the rest of it, like I gave away, you know, all of my deserts and all my wintergreen.
Marpat.
I gave all stuff away. And now, like years later, I'm like, man, I really wish I would have kept that stuff. But I wasn't really interested.
Yeah, because they had the Eagle Globe and Anchor embedded inside of the material. Yeah,
and this
is, you
know, this is stuff I'd worn, worn for years. It was like all nice and broken in. And anyway.
And Recon touched as well. So there's a little bit of that, right? Was, I mean, there is some baseball card.
All of our uniforms.
You know.
And, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. Some paracord here, you know.
Yeah, and like a lot of like, you know, like sewing down pockets and stuff like that, you know, Velcro instead of buttons, because buttons can fall off, right?
Well, you don't want to iron buttons over your uniform anyways and like have those button marks.
Well, and so snipers were like really big on debating whether you wanted Velcro because then your buttons wouldn't fall off. It makes a noise. I borrowed from the British, and what I did was I took their buttons. Sometimes I would take like a hot metal and kind of knock out the holes in our buttons. And just sew them with 550 cord because it was stronger, right? But I went into studying fashion design after I got out of the military. I knew I wanted to go into something with art. I loved drawing. I was really interested in just doing something creative. When I'm going into fashion design, I studied that for 2 years in California at Otis College of Art and Design. I got more into the menswear and tailoring side of things, for which I moved to London about a year and a half, and I studied bespoke tailoring, which is like making suits.
Oh, wow.
Specific to one client, and you're making it by hand. You know, it's hundreds of hours of labor per suit, and it takes, if I'm honest, probably longer than a year and a half to learn how to do it properly.
You're going down with chalk lines. You're like taking that and like marking it on.
Exactly. So a customer comes in, you take like 20 different measurements of them. You also look at like how do they stand, right? How do they stand? You know, what do they do for a living? How are they spending their days, right? How are they commuting? You look at, you know, their figuration, right? Do they have wide set feet? Do they have like a sort of hunchback or a dropped shoulder? Soldiers would typically have a very dropped shoulder because they've been carrying a rifle for such a long time, right?
Let's sit up straight. Excuse me.
you and me both. And then, you know, you make by hand a pattern for them. You cut out basically a rough draft of the garment. That takes probably 30 hours. You put the garment on them.
Wow.
Then you completely disassemble the garment, make the corrections. Make the first version of the finished garment, make additional corrections and another fitting, and then you make kind of the final thing that's about 90% of the way there, and then you do another fitting, generally, and then you finish out the garment.
I love
All
it.
In, you're talking about in excess of 300 hours on a single garment, right? So I did that for a year and a half, came back, I switched into industrial design, did kind of my final years of university in that, and then I got into design, and it wasn't until even a little bit after that I started to get interested in camouflage. It wasn't something I wore or was really interested in when I was in fashion, because I was working for, you know, GQ magazine for years, British GQ. I kind of wanted to get away from the military and sort of see what my life and personality would be like without that. Mm-hmm. That was part of it. I also felt like in a lot of settings, camouflage is not camouflage, right? If you're wearing camouflage in a foreign country, that puts you on, you know, like a certain kind of radar, and you don't know exactly what that is or what that interaction might be. America has a super positive, you know, relationship with our military. Almost every other country on earth does not, right? A lot of them have like an outright negative
one. Yeah, it's illegal to wear it in Bermuda.
It's illegal to wear it.
It's illegal to wear camouflage in Bermuda.
It's illegal to wear it in Bermuda. It's also illegal to wear it in many parts of India. Because they have a history of armed revolution there, right? The same thing, you know, in South America, right? Like it has distinct ongoing connotations of armed conflict, right? So it's going to get you a lot of local attention you don't want. It's also going to get you maybe attention from the authorities that you don't want. I've gotten kind of taken down in Eastern India before for like wearing kind of not even camouflage stuff, just sort of like safari colors.
Right. That's what I was going to ask that. Yeah.
To sort of, you know, talk my way out of. But the history of camouflage kind of grew on me like a little bit more and more. I became kind of nostalgic for it a little bit. And mostly just started popping up in the periphery, right? So I remember Rhodesian brushstroke was a thing probably like 5 years ago.
I love it.
It was a big thing. And I remember like I've seen this before, but where? And I was like, oh, was it when I was in Djibouti? Or like hanging out around Somalia. I was like, is that when I was seeing it? No.
Oh,
I had to kind of, I had to like dig into the recesses of my mind. And I realized that my unit had done a combat man tracking course with some guys who were, it was a Rhodesian, former Rhodesian operation, right? And all the trainers there had been trained by like Rhodesian guys, and they were wearing some of the stuff. And that was like the first camouflage that I had like a kind of emotional connection to, because I was like, this was one training cycle in the Marines that like I just had fun. You weren't on a base. You weren't being, you know, you weren't being trained by your peers. You were being trained by these guys who were kind of like, kind of granola guys, right? Yeah, it was hard because you were doing a lot of movements. You're doing a lot of movements and they were really trying to run you ragged, but it was also fun. It kind of went back to like airsofting as a kid. You're out in the forest. You got your buddies. It's not so serious. It's not so controlled. Someone's getting hunted. Someone's hunting. It reminded me of like the movie Hunted. And it was just, it was a really good memory that I had from the military, because like you were doing something that was cool. You were learning. It wasn't so stressful. And you were kind of, you're with all your military buddies, but you were not in this super serious demand.
It wasn't so mental.
Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like, you know, like pre-dive or something like that, or doing like an indoc where every single thing you do is being watched. And if you fuck up, you don't have the right attitude. You just flip over your boys. It wasn't like that. It was much more relaxed because these were civilians that were putting on the course. So I remember I found these guys actually at SHOT Show who had like surplus Rhodesian breaststroke Fire Force Ventures or something like that. I think they've since moved to the US. And I was like, dude, I got to get a pair of these pants. Started wearing them. That was like the first piece of camouflage I really started wearing like post-military life. And it was good because like there was environments where it made sense. I think I did wind up wearing that to India and like camping and stuff. But there was also one interaction I had that kind of reminded me like, oh, like these things have deep personal connotations to other people and they're not always going to be positive, right? With Rhodesian brushstroke, you got to be, you know, really aware of that, right? I wore it going to Washington, D.C. to do a shoot for a fashion brand out there. And I was waiting for a cab, taxi, Uber, whatever. And there was this older guy, distinguished guy. He's like, kind of, he's dressed up a little bit. And he looks down at me and he like keeps looking at my pants. And I kind of had a bad flight. And I was like, this guy fucking looking at my pants. Like, like, I don't want to get in a fight at the airport, man. Like, you know, just like, you don't like my pants. You just tell me you don't like my pants. So I just kind of, I got a little arrogant. And I was like, so you like my pants? You know? And he was kind of a little bit taken aback. And he responded with a little bit of an accent that was a little strange. And he said, you know, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that in about 40 years. And I said, oh, when was the last time you saw us? And he says, well, I was dropping off like 10 boys into the bush. I never saw them again. And I was like, and he got kind of choked up. And I was like, whoa, what, like, what do you mean? And he's like, oh, I was, you know, I was a pilot in Rhodesia. And like when things started to go bad there, he left. He did some other things in South America. I won't ask what he was doing in Washington, D.C. I did ask him if he was still flying and he said yes. But that was one of those interactions where I was like, okay, like you do have to remember it's cool and it's interesting and I have my personal take on this, but it also has really serious emotional connotations to other people, right? But that emotion, positive or negative, I think that's, and this is true of like all military clothing, right? That emotion is also kind of my interest, right? Like it could be positive, it could be negative, but because it's tied to history and it's tied to service and it's tied to sacrifice, and it's tied to victory and it's tied to defeat, right? Mm-hmm. There's such a strong emotional vein there as a designer that you can mine, right? And I don't see really anything in fashion today, like capital F fashion industry, that has that strength, right? It's like trends and it's invented and it's like the Barbie movie and it's like 90s Nirvana stuff or whatever. Very few of those things ring with like real nostalgia, real emotional content the way camouflage does.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. I love it. I do love talking about camouflage, period. It's just fascinating because I've got a pair of size 40-inch waist DPMs,
oh, wow.
British DPM, on their way over to me right now, you know, and I was in my shop the other day, and the same night I was looking at shorts, right? I was like, oh, no one around here has any, you know, British DPM issued shorts. Can I find some of my size? I go walking into my airsoft shop, and my buddy Xander, who you met at SHOT Show with the ski mask. Bro, he has them on already. I'm like, Xander, what are you wearing? And he's got like the hiking boots going on. He's got the shorts. He's got his gun on his hip. Yeah. He's all in the shop. I was like, I was just looking at those last night and you already have them. That's not fair. So we kind of have this thing going back and forth. So I got like French and Finnish pants that turn white or camouflage.
Oh,
those are great. I love my Finnish pants, dude.
Well,
yes.
The short thing is interesting, right? Like the American military, in terms of something that's been issued, has never done shorts in camouflage, right? You've got the Vietnam stuff that was like, you know, you could have like a mama-san kind of whip you up a pair of shorts or cut your trousers into shorts.
Or you got ranger panties, as they call them, that they run around and do their PT short-wise.
You know, your black silkies. It's like there's this like mythos about this thing, but it's always kind of like on the dark side because it's never been official issued, right? I think that's why people are so attached to it. So you had like custom made stuff in Vietnam. You've got like the Ranger panties, black silkies, whatever. There's been huge internal wars within the Marine Corps about those and their regulations, right? Everyone's attracted to them. Everyone loves them. They look terrible and they terrify women, but that's fine. We love them anyway. There's the
you got legs. If you can wear those, you're in shape. Yeah. Let's just be clear. Athletes, dude, you guys are just like running. Yeah. It's like, you don't Well, you need things that don't UDTs, constrict you.
Right. So like UDT shorts. Yeah. Are not comfortable. They're not it's not the best range of motion you could ever have. Certainly no one's wearing them outside of like a training environment, but guys are incredibly attached to those, right? But we've never actually been issued like duty shorts, right? But like the Brits, the Australians, basically every other military has some kind of version of this. And I remember in Afghanistan on my first deployment there, like trading basically every excess piece of kit I had to get these British shorts. Guys would cut theirs off and make them into shorts, right? But also they were issued with ones. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. It came in the British version of multicam, which was like all terrain. I think they call it
MTP, multicam training pattern.
Yeah. They have their version of it.
It's multicam training pattern.
It was so close to multicam. You could wear the two together.
But they have the DPM brush strokes.
Right. It has,
that's the difference between their multi.
That brush stroke, like pixelation too.
Yes.
And the fabric was amazing. And they had like, they were real, you know, cargo shorts. They had that kind of rope on the inside for tying them off. Really great.
Around the waist and everything. It's perfect.
Yeah, and they had like the tab adjusters. Really great shorts. I still have a couple pairs of those in my archive. But the other place that I've seen them recently, because like American military never happened. Guys, at least in the Marines, would make a big deal of when they EES'd, cutting off, you know, their duty trousers, right? Their field trousers into shorts. But like it never really, it doesn't really look good. But guys were stoked to do that because I mean, you were kind of like a free man. You could go hang out on the beach or whatever. But I'm now seeing, like, the last trip I did to Ukraine, I did a story for Esquire out there. And one of the things I noticed is, like, these younger guys that I saw at the beginning of the war, 18, 19, you know, early 20s, who didn't really have a lot of experience, some of them, quite a lot of them, have gotten really into the fight and what they're doing and have become really, really self-studied, right? And, like, in the space of a little bit over a year now, they've really, really progressed, right? Like, you see these younger guys, you'll see groups like one of them's called Gonar. It's all young guys. They have developed their own initiative-based tactics. They train a lot. There's a lot of kind of simulation and reading from the book of, like, American Special Forces and, like, that, the whole kind of culture that rotates around that. And these guys are all wearing Cry shorts. Not all of them, but quite a lot of them are wearing, like, the Cry, like, G-series combat shorts. How much of it is actual Cry precision? How much of it is, like, local knockoffs? I'd probably put that at, like, probably 10% the real thing, 90% knockoffs. But these guys are probably the ones that bring combat shorts into the mainstream, because, like, they're kind of, they're writing their own book. Their conflict is being so well documented. I think they're going to kind of, they're going to kind of push uniforms in that, you know, in that direction. And that was, like, a big shift. Like, you know, obviously it's seasonal as well, because in Ukraine, like, the winter is deadly serious cold. And I've never actually been there in the summer, but I know, especially in the South, it gets super hot, right? You're talking about Mediterranean style, you know, temperatures and environments. So we'll kind of see, we'll see what happens with that. The Ukrainians are also not, they're not so concerned. They're not really concerned at all with, like, uniform regulations as well. So, like,
just color identification.
Yeah. Well, they, I mean, their stuff is,
they just look like a bunch of airsofters with red, yellow, and blue on their arms.
I'm not going to, when I got there and I expected,
and I love that because they have their gear,
right?
Probably from playing. Someone's like, wait, is this for real now?
Well, and I expected that there would be less of that with time.
Yeah.
In the beginning of the war, there was huge problems with blue on blue and civilians getting aggressed.
Friendly fire.
Yeah, accidentally. Because, like, there was a huge problem with internal espionage and spies, like Russian kind of forces that had been embedded there for a long time. But people have actually gotten kind of more marked up, not less, with time. That's interesting. And, like, you know, you would expect training gets better, PID gets better, blue on blue should be reduced, right? Maybe that's not the case, or maybe they're just being very proactive about it. But it's also the fact that, like, everyone just kind of wears not whatever they want, but in a lot of units, you can kind of get away with, like, whatever kind of camouflage you want. Part of that is, you know, necessity. They have to outfit all of these guys, and bad camouflage is still better than, well, to a degree, better than no camouflage, right? But still seeing guys out there with, like, that weird Russian orange reddish Kryptek, tons of old
British KLMK.
Like knockoff American camouflage, a lot of excess ACU stuff. Some interesting pieces too. Like, I've seen and found some Tiger Stripe out there.
I wouldn't even.
It's pretty wild, but I think, like, the irregularity of the uniforms is another reason that these guys, like, have to do the color coded stuff so much.
Yes.
Because, like, they're mixing in their standard uniform as it is doesn't really look that different from Russian. They're using a lot of Russian equipment as is, and then
maybe their comms aren't all dialed into each other's units, and there's these scattered people who are training together from other villages, and then they only can identify with yellow and blue. And so they're like, you know, are you a lost patrol? Well, yeah, we are here too. We're yellow and you're blue.
Yeah, no, they do, like, they do the World War II style, you know, passwords and colors and things like that.
Yeah.
And there's a good reason for it. You know, communication with lateral units is something that the Ukrainians have gotten only a little bit better at with the war. They're definitely better at it than Russians, but that's a problem. And you don't, because there's so many layers of military, there's, you know, territorial defense that's guarding villages and is kind of like that was backed up against the front line. And then you've got whatever line units are responsible for that area. And then you've got, you know, kind of like random artillery and aerial reconnaissance units operating in that area. Mm-hmm. And then you might also have reconnaissance or sort of skirmishing units coming in with, like, very little orchestration. So that's, like, that's a problem. You could very easily, and I've seen this happen at least twice, very easily, like, be in an AO, think you know the battle space, think you know what artillery is in support of you, and then some unit rolls up and goes and hits something, and you're like, who are these fucking dudes in this, you know, passenger van. Like, what? And you just kind of look and are
like, what's going on here? Yeah.
Are these guys the business? Are they our guys? Are they someone else's guys? There's also quite a lot, and I think this is on both sides of the book, there's quite a lot of action that goes across the front line that's plainclothes. So that's a whole nother, you know, that's a whole nother aspect of this. But because of that, like, lack of not so great communication across units, not the best integration and situational awareness, I think the color coding thing is like, it's really important.
Yeah. I chuckle about it, but I understand it 100%, you know, and it is makes sense.
But it makes the uniform that much easier for guys who airsoft, right?
Well, I'm just looking at the photos from, like, you know, yeah, dude, our games. It's like, well, how far off is airsoft war games versus, you know, the real death? We don't want that. We don't deal with the real death. And that's sad, you know, and the war's hell, and you've seen it firsthand. So,
well,
you know, I'm not trying to.
There is something interesting in that. Like, not so much now because people are really caught up, but I was noticing the first 3 months of the invasion, you'd run into like younger guys who didn't seem to have a military background, but like they knew their shit. It's like,
yeah,
the way their gear was set up, the way they were holding their weapons, the way they're manipulating their weapons was like spot on. And it was like very westernized. And it was not what the older generation who had military was doing. And there might be some things that they were a little bit unfamiliar with, like, you know, communications and artillery and stuff like that. You could see they were quick learners. I remember seeing one of these kids. He looked like he was like 20 at best. Very, like, you know, like very baby faced. And he was with essentially like a regular volunteer unit. And he'd just come back from the most insane raid I've ever heard of in my life, which was him, three other guys total. They pushed about 2 or 3 kilometers into a Russian held village, located the headquarters, dispersed on two sides of it, had, you know, outward and inward facing cover, and were going to put grenades to the windows, right? Some kind of armored vehicle, they couldn't tell me what, with, you know, a 25 millimeter gun opened up on them and literally opened up on their own, the Russian self headquarters, right? Oh. I think they popped on thermals. The guys held their fire, held their grenades, and bounded back out of the village, right? And made it out with zero casualties. And I just looked at this kid and I was like, A, you're insane for ever doing that. Like, that's like, no, an American military unit would never task someone with doing that. Secondly, you guys were incredibly disciplined because you held your fire. If they had opened up, right? If they had hit the headquarters or they had, you know, tried to put down suppressing fire on whatever this armored vehicle was, they would have gotten smoked and it would have brought every single Russian in that village out because they would have heard the counterfire, right? And known that this was vehicle lighting something up, but something, you know, more serious than an actual counterattack, right? Especially because the armored vehicle opening up on the headquarters, I think, was probably interpreted as someone who didn't know how to work thermals initiating like a blue on blue. They made that a lot.
That was them blue on blue themselves. Yeah. They baited them basically to shoot the...
Yeah, which wasn't planned, but it, like, I think the whole thing just led us confusion. And when they egressed from this town, they weren't dealing with small arms fire, right? They didn't take any casualties.
They were just like, dude, they just killed themselves.
Yeah,
they're laughing on the way home.
I talked to this
kid. Dude, like, they just kicked their own ass.
I talked to this kid. He was obviously the team leader, and I was like, so you have any military experience? And he's like, no, you know, like I was doing some military studies in college, and like that's it. I was never in a unit. And I was like, no, like this kid knows something. There's no way he got this trained, especially in this unit, because they were not that well trained at the time. There's like no way. And I was like, you airsoft? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, how many years have you been airsofting, right? And like, you know, I got his social details and like, kid has an airsoft team. He's been doing it since he was 14. And like, okay, that, you know, might terrify.
Then those cries are probably 25% legit.
Right. And, And you know, like he knew the gear, he knew all the stuff, and I don't know, you know, how serious he took training when he was airsofting or whatever, but even just learning from dumb mistakes airsofting, he was capable of leading a squad, carrying out a mission, and doing some really, really intelligent in the moment decision making. So, you know, we might laugh, we might joke about it, but I would say the same thing about video games like Call of Duty. There was tons of guys who, like, that was their baseline experience, but they learned how to communicate and learned how to work in a team, and that team became a real fire team. So we might laugh and joke about it, but like conflicts from this point on, the baseline and the kind of leaders of those conflicts, at least on the ground, are going to be, especially outside of the US, guys who come from airsofting and video games.
True, it's true.
A lot of the recce kids that I met who are like aerial reconnaissance, they do drones, drone strikes. They're really good at what they do. They're like really into kind of like hacking their drones and making them more lethal. And they're really good at what they do, right? Like they've rewritten the book on drones. Talk to all those kids and I'm like, so like, how did you get into this? Right? Like, what led you to this unit? And they all said exactly the same thing. They're like, I used to play Arma, video games, Call of Duty, whatever. I knew I was good at video games. I didn't think I was going to be a good infantry guy. So like, I want to grow.
And Arma, dude, for sure.
Yeah. So
if you're playing Arma, you're squad based tactics. You're like, Roger that, moving out, going over.
Yeah. And they like, they got, you know, it's a crazy thing to say, but like video games and airsoft have become like, that's the baseline for the next generations of war. And it's kind of,
well, Robert, it's happening right now. I mean, my best friend that's worked, Xander, who you took a photo, he just became a National Guardsman today. Like he's going to drill.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's,
you know, 25 years old.
It's
but his drill sergeant said, how come you know all about this helmet in boot camp? He's like, oh, you mean because I have one? He's like, Rad, the funniest thing was when my drill sergeant was like bragging about his gear. And I'm thinking, oh, he had Comtex. Right. He's like, yeah, I got these $1,300 Comtex, his drill sergeant. And Xander's like, bro, I've got like two sets at home under my pillow.
Yeah.
You know, like already these kids, these young men and women going in have been kind of disciplined, a little left, right, left, holding it proper.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's all that. There's like the language, right? There's also the kind of, there's sort of like a militia mindset to it as well. Like Ukraine, very much unlike the United States, access to firearms as a civilian is almost zero. You really have to be in the good graces of your local like police officer, which means bribery, essentially. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, any kind of rifle or something like that. There are very, very, very few military pattern weapons available in Ukraine. It's mostly like hunting stuff. And because there's no local interest in it prior to the war, none of it was really imported. Pistols, like forget about it. Like you can't have one. I think you have to be on like the Olympic shooting team and it has to be kept at a range. And it's like, this is not going to happen. But the beginning of the war,
completely strict on.
Yeah, it's really like, it's really strict. And most people, you know, most people I talk to, they would say like, no, I would never like, now we really wish we had American gun laws, right? But in the past, we never considered it because basically it made you really susceptible to like bribery, and you would have to deal with the police all the time. It just wasn't like, it wasn't something that made sense to most people because it wasn't really it was very much like a waivable privilege, right? But there were these guys at the beginning of the war, and there was like one in almost every single unit who had, you know, been into video games, whatever, was really into guns, and had like gone through all the loopholes and procedures and X, Y, and Z, and like gotten the kit and knew how to make their own ammunition and knew how to set up weapons. And these guys wound up, you know, kitting out basically entire platoons and also taking on training and working as like farmers and setting people up. I saw quite a lot of, like, there was at every unit, there was like one guy like that. And it really made a difference, because on the other side of that,
100%,
you were going around these villages and you were seeing kids, you know, some old enough to join, some not, going from like post to post, trying to join and talking to the territorial defense guys and being like, can we fight? Can we fight? Like, can you give us a rifle? Can we do something? And there just wasn't enough resources to go around. And even, I think, more important than the lack of arms that can be distributed, and you know, anyone in the experience knows this, the more important thing than the weapon is the training. It's not a good thing to hand out tons of weapons to people who don't know what they're doing, right? And Ukraine was pretty restricted with that. But the weapons you do have, if those are in the hands of people who don't know how to utilize them, right, don't know how to maintain them, don't know how to effectively employ them, don't know how they function, you know, tactically on like a platoon level or something like that, you're not really doing yourself any favors. So there's some lessons to be learned, not just in like the next generation kind of riding on, you know, airsoft and video games, but also the value of having a few guys who have like real wood and steel skills, right?
Some talent. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
And if you're my listener and you're listening and you're thinking about joining the military in the U.S. or wherever, give it a shot. You know, we're looking for good, talented individuals to take the slots to hold down the fort and to keep America under its freedom flag that we live under. So I'm not paid by any major army company or anybody like that to say this.
Just mention Rad if you get recruited. No reason.
Yeah, just mention Rad. Just mention Airsoft. No. In fact, at Airsoft games, I just want to be clear, I have a strict policy of no recruiting allowed. So if a recruiter wants to like dive in and come in and get to my games, it's like, you can't unless you're fighting alongside that individual. Come out and play, come out and get into the trenches and let them rub your shoulder. And then they'll be like, wow, you're in the Army, dude? Or you're in the Marine Corps, dude? Be like, yeah, talk to me about it later. Right now, let's go get the satellite that's down. Yeah. You know, if you can move forward, it's going to work out in your best interest other than like sign this card, give me your phone number,
You also, you also get whooped by these kids. Like,
yeah,
I did a little bit of airsoft when I was a kid. And then during lockdown, I cloned my rifles and pistols that I have at home in gas blowback airsoft and as much metal as possible. Because I was like, ranges are shut. I want to be training every single day again. Yep. I got the time. Like, let's do it. A, I was blown away. Like, the weapons and everything have gotten so much better. B, it was like just super fun to be able to like set up the range in 5 minutes and be shooting every day. But eventually, when I was getting ready to go back to Afghanistan, I went and did a couple of games. Just because I was like, you know what? I want to get used to kind of like being in a kinetic environment again and like loud noises and stuff. Like, I just kind of want to jumpstart things. And like, you know, I had made some clothing to go out there and stuff. And I'm like, I really want to test this and see if this stuff works, right? Man, I got spanked. I went in there and I was like, I'm a Force Recon badass. I've done CQB for X, Y, and Z hours.
Sure.
I'm just smoke all these kids. Sorry, boys. Nah, I got spanked, dude.
I got this young man named Mason. Hard. He's 11. He's a killer in the arena, dude. He has got it. He is so fast. Yeah. You would never suspect him. He's that kid that would be walking along with the basket in Ukraine. He's 11 and he's going to take you out, bro. These kids are, like you said, give him 5 more years of doing what he's doing right now. When he steps inside of a CQB house at some military, they're going to be like, how do you know all of this?
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, my experience of that, because like I was shooting for months, just airsoft gas stuff off of my porch. And then things kind of opened up a little bit and went to the actual range. And I was like, my groups and shooting with a rifle was actually like was probably the best it had been in a decade. My work with a pistol was garbage. My transitions were fine. That was all good. But man, that the kick on an actual 45 versus an airsoft.
Your airsoft blowback is totally different.
But it was legitimate. Like my rifle work got better. You get, you know, you're practicing your footwork and your manipulations and all that stuff.
Nothing gets rid of the smell and the fire and the loudness of that. You know what I mean? There's nothing ever going to replace the the death you're wielding out of a barrel of a real gun.
Yeah.
Okay, that boom, that recoil. Yeah. Correct. And you're a little desensitized. Just a little bit.
Well, yeah, you're, that's kind of why I went into these games, it's like, I want to get past that moment of initial shock. If I'm going to Afghanistan again and something does happen and I'm going to an environment where, like, hey, there's a couple car bombings every day and there's just shootings in the street sometimes, I don't want to have like a hiccup, right? Like,
well, you gotta
going to these games a little bit and getting back to the mindset of like, okay, we're not freezing, we're reacting to things. And yeah, like, yeah, there might be loud noises and stuff. That really helps. And it was also, this sounds really strange, but it was a really great way to take out gear and equipment. So I made some like my versions of kind of local Afghan clothing to go back. And it was good to like throw that on and throw on some other things I've designed and like 12 hours of gaming it and being like, oh yeah, like this, you know, this isn't comfortable or this snags here or like this doesn't actually,
exactly,
this doesn't integrate the way exactly I thought it did, right? And that saved me like so many pain points when I was actually, you know, out doing the job.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I mean, trial and error happens all the time in airsoft. You know, you get to redo it and like walk the same steps or walk a different step and try it again a different way, whereas the other way got you shot. In the real world, you get shot, you're done most of the time.
Yeah.
In airsoft, it gives you a chance to go back, regroup your brain, suck up your pride, and go back at it again.
Yeah.
And again, just like in a gym, like in a boxing ring, you know.
Yeah.
But that fighter coming at you is looking to throw blows, so you got to be ready.
Well, and I think one of the most valuable aspects of that was it's so different working against an actual adversary than steel. You know what I mean? Steel or paper targets, like whatever you're shooting.
What's it doing at
you? Just like wow, this person is like moving, thinking, you know what I mean? And you're doing the same.
But you're calling out targets at 1 o'clock, moving up a hill 300 feet away, and you got another target out at the left, and you're like, hey, he's out to the west, 600 feet out, you know, and you got multiple targets and you're getting engaged. You're just calling out all of these different.
Just, it makes it, it, in that way, I think it makes it more realistic than some of the live fire stuff you do in the military, because what I've seen in real life, like no one is ever firing from a traditional firing position, right? Things are always at like the extreme limit, more often than not, the extreme limit of engagement. Things are not happening in like a clean, flat, squad bay style environment. There's always ambiguities, right? Your squad or team or whatever that's moving, like it's rare that they're going to be in the perfect formation that you've planned because of training.
Right.
And airsoft, for all the things about it, they can't be made realistic. All of those factors are pretty accurately represented, right? So like I think there's some real value in there, and I wouldn't
surprise. I think my team's communication skills are top notch. You know, all my guys and gals on the team, there's about 20 of them, they all got radios, and we can all just break down into squad based elements and move off into the grid, and they can use their hand to identify mountains and valleys and saddles and, you know, just the littlest simple. Yeah. And that's all just airsoft, because what are we doing? We're out in the mountains. We're out in the saddles. We're out in the valleys. We're fighting hilltop to hilltop. So it's best to know what you're calling out so you don't call out the wrong stuff. It's just little things, you know, 20 years of doing it. It's my dad, before he passed away, being a Green Beret, he was just like, you know, Aaron, he said, we would do these stress tests for like 72 hours out of Camp Williams, where they would send us with a map and a grid and say, you got to go from point A to point B. And expect contact. And so here they are doing what they signed up to do, get into contact. They're like, we want to go get into contact. Yeah. Okay. So they're going on the stress test. And he's like, at the end of it, all we do is get to a fire and some other dude in a beanie stoking the fire saying, you're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, where's the contact? He's like, airsoft. This was back in like 04, 05. Yeah. He's like, I see this being, you know, an actual tangible thing where I could get hit and it can be used. And now today, Dad, I love you. I know you're in heaven or wherever you're at. I have used airsoft in military settings against the military in this exact thing at Camp Williams.
Yeah.
So I just want to say.
Yeah.
It matters.
I think there's a lot of practicality there. It's also like you can take it up and train with it anywhere.
You did cheaper than like Sims.
We did that. Yeah. We did sim munitions, that like blue paint stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not. Okay, you get a little bit more blowback or whatever. There's some safety things, whatever. Having to switch out the barrels and all the stuff, that was a huge hassle. Yep. I remember like the first time we used that stuff, we had some raid scenario, and the whole thing got fucked up just because everyone's masks fogged, right? Mm-hmm. And like people hadn't, like we hadn't quite figured out like how to set up our optics to like clear the mask we were wearing. And it was like, okay,
right, you needed like a riser mount on it so you could see through over it, and versus
you know, the mask wasn't something we planned around, and like, okay, it was realistic sort of in kick or whatever, but at the end of the day it had made it so unrealistic in other scenarios that it didn't really
So now today you can just wear a pair of, like, let's just say these are safety glasses, and there's a mesh mask that covers your teeth so you can still breathe. Yeah. And so the whole breathability prevents the fogging of your lenses. So you don't want to shoot your teeth out. You don't want to shoot your eyes out. So what do you got to do? Instead of wearing the full headgear, you just wear a lower mesh mask and then some eye pro. And you do have the nose area and like your orbital is susceptible to being shot. But I mean, come on, you deserve it.
Yeah. So like, you know, some dueling scars or whatever. But you know, exactly.
Like your throat gets shot. But I mean, honestly, it's your teeth. That's the number one injury, is teeth shot out in airsoft. People not taking precautions to wear their mask. Or my one airman up here at Hill, he's like, he comes up, he's like, I was like, oh, did you get your tooth shot out, dude? He's like, And I was like, don't drink no water. And he wanted to immediately drink water when I said that. And it just was, and I said, where's your mask? You've been wearing it all day. He's like, I took it off for the last game. I was like, bro. Dude.
Yeah. Well, even with things like that, you also, I think you realize what the more likely mechanisms of injury are, right? Like the amount of times when I was airsofting, I would get shot in the
trips and falls.
And you realize close range, like, yeah, like people, you know, aim center mass or weapon center mass, you get hit in the hands. You know, ricochets too. Like that was something that we were told quite a lot about for our like cover shoot drills in recon, like a big thing for counter ambush stuff. And to effectively counter ambushes when you get in them. This is something that came from like Parisian cell scouts thing. And we were told about it and we tested it a few times live fire. And we're like, okay, yeah, like cool, this works. But is this maybe in the realm of like 70s cop videos where this is some crazy theory and it has no practicality in real life? And the few times I did airsoft, I was like, oh, dude, I'm getting stuff bouncing around and bouncing off things all the time. And sure, this is plastic or whatever, but bullets fall, and it's the same thing. So maybe I need to reconsider.
All hits count, and we call that.
Yeah.
And we say all hits count here, so that you don't have this. Oh, I got shot in the ass cheek. I'm alive. No, man, just get rid of any. If you get shot, you think you got shot, you die. Yeah. Just die. Just call it and start over.
Yeah.
And then if you have a question about ricochets, just ask Ronald Reagan if they're real or not. Okay, because that's how he got shot, my friend. His limousine window was what ricocheted their bullet when they were fighting over the Uzi the guy had or whatever, and it shot into Reagan.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a ricochet off his limousine's window. It wasn't even like a direct shot at Reagan.
Yeah, and no doubt, like the window was bulletproof, right? Wow. Okay.
Exactly, on his limo, on his own limo. His own limo's bulletproof window ricocheted into the president's gut. Yeah, because they were tackling him when he was coming at him with the gun. Yeah, so that's why I say ricochets count.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for sure they do. Like, that's, you know.
For sure they do.
For sure they do. And like,
now, listen, Robert, listen, I have had you, dude. We've been talking. I love it. And you have a book, right?
I do.
Tell me the name of your book. Let's get that on this. Tell me the name of your book.
It's the name of the book. It's my first book. It's a photo book. It's Afghan style. Big book. Don't get intimidated. There are chapters, but there are very few words. So Afghan style, I started working on with my first trip as a photographer to Afghanistan in 2021, Esquire magazine. I went back in 2022, which is obviously after the Taliban had taken over the country, and worked some more on that project. Post-military, I spent more than a decade now, working as a fashion photographer, right? And most specifically covering fashion weeks around the world. I think at the peak of that, pre-2020, I was doing like 25 fashion weeks a year and traveling 35 weeks out of the year. Really paying attention to personal style, cultural style around the world, kind of what's going on culturally with that. But really like living in the minutia of just obsessing and examining what people are wearing and what it says, right? In 2017, I started doing conflict reporting. So I went to Kurdistan and northern Iraq when ISIS was getting pushed out of Mosul, like the closing several months of that conflict. So that kind of led me to an intersection of these two interests, which is the book Afghan Style. For me, you know, personally, and since this is in the context of kind of a military environment. Yes. Afghanistan was a place that I thought about every single day since the first time I went there. I really expected, kind of like an old lover, like one day you would just get over it and you'd stop thinking about it, right? Especially my final deployment ended with bin Laden being killed. And to me, like, I was like, really, I think this chapter of my life is over now. But, you know, a decade on, I'm still thinking about this place every single day. The same with my teammates. Like, we still talk about when something comes up in the news. And I just kind of felt on an instinctive emotional level, like, I want to go back to this place. And I don't know what I expect to find or what I expect to learn. But I feel like if I confront this with an experience, I'll find some kind of resolution, which I did. I spent about a month and a half there on this first trip. I studied a bit of Dari. I was living in Kabul. I wasn't living in a hotel. I wasn't living on a base somewhere. And I spent almost every single day of that month and a half just on the street, interacting with people, taking photos, biking around, making friends, kind of like getting into it and learning. And when I came away, I had way more photos than I needed for this tour I did for Esquire. I'd come to really understand Afghan culture. And also in a way that the military experience that I had there never had. I didn't feel like in two deployments I'd ever come to understand Afghans at all. They were a mystery when I arrived. They were a mystery when I left. And I think anyone, even just in a military context who studies military strategy, knows it's a extreme error not to understand both your allies and your adversaries, right? In this case, Afghans could be either, and I didn't understand them. So after this month and a half trip, I really felt like I understood them a little bit. And also I had a lot of respect for them. They were the most prideful people I'd ever met in my entire life. Like, pride, what pride means to an Afghan man has no equivalent in Western society. It's everything to people who have nothing. So I came to respect them a lot for that. And my own kind of personal obsession with style, these guys were kind of like the quintessence of it, right? They have nothing. They're starving. They're illiterate. Their life expectancy is like 50 if they're lucky. If they're 50 years old, they spent 40 of those years inside of some kind of war.
In war. Yeah.
If anyone has an excuse to just like dress like shit and not worry about it, it's these guys, right? And yet, almost every single Afghan man I met really put such attention and care in what they were wearing, right? It's like old Mujahideen commanders who've like lost legs, don't really have much going for them in life, and probably only have two sets of clothing, and they're still ironing it out and tailoring it and like looking presentable each day. It's the attention and care that they put into like grooming and etiquette. All that stuff really, it just impressed me and it blew me away. And I was like, you know what? I want to create a volume that is a study of their style. I didn't know exactly what was going to happen to Afghanistan in 2021.
Yeah.
I think everyone had the sense that the government was going to collapse, but we didn't think it was going to happen as soon as it did. So this kind of became a historical document for me. Like, the Afghanistan that I've had the privilege of photographing, that I've been entangled with for more than a decade now in my own life, almost two decades actually, will probably not exist a decade from now, right? The country's isolated economically, geographically. When those gates eventually open, because the Taliban dissolves or they modernize or whatever, the clothing and the culture will disappear and recede. I had committed to a book, doing a book, when the Taliban swept across the country in August. And I was meant to go back that summer. I remember like getting my visa. Like, I had three visas for the country, trying to go back. The wheels really came off. There was no way to get back in country. My friends there were freaking out and trying to get out. And at that point, I realized, okay, like, the story's changed. I can't publish this book anymore because things have changed historically in the period of 6 months. To an irreparable degree, the Taliban is now in control. This isn't a complete document anymore. So about a year went by. I was still working on the book with a publisher, but we mutually decided that I was going to go back to Afghanistan under Taliban rule and attempt to add more to the project to talk about what has historically changed since they've taken power. I was meant to go in spring. Obviously, Ukraine happened. That got pushed back. I wound up going in August, which was, you know, unmercifully hot. It meant integrating face to face and with the full acknowledgement of the Taliban. They run the government there. You're not doing anything, including leaving the airport without their permission. It was extremely strange to be sitting in multiple rooms of Taliban armed with American weapons, using American equipment, and kind of getting their permission to go around the country and take these photos, photographing Taliban inside of, you know, former American compounds. A lot of the guys that I met had been fighting against Americans. One that I met had been in an American military prison for like 2 years. That was pretty, like, it was very gut-wrenching and weird. Like, surely they've got Google and they know who I am and who my, you know, what my background is. In the end, you know, the conclusion wasn't positive, right? You have to look back on a 20-year endeavor that didn't really accomplish anything, especially for Afghans.
Yeah.
You can quite clearly, especially if you spent time there and understand the culture, that's one of the reasons I wanted to make the book, you can really clearly see the obvious mistakes that were made. But there was resolution for me because, like, okay, the outcome is not positive here, but I've seen the thing and I've been a part of the thing and I've confronted it and I understand, and understanding what went wrong and why it went wrong, that's given me personally some kind of peace, or I'm much more okay with it than a lot of other veterans I know who served in Afghanistan. And that's kind of, that's been worth it. I also hope that, like, the book's been very well received by Afghans and just by, you know, by the public in general. We've done a little bit of a book tour in Europe and I'm doing one.
I'm sure you would like, you want that blessing from them. You know, you really want to showcase them and show off the,
yeah, it's the fashion, it's not, right? It's like not expected. Like, I didn't, this wasn't a book for Afghans because if you're from Afghanistan, like, you'll know these things already. That wasn't really the design. The design was really like, I want to make a document that's approachable, that's non-political and non-religious, and presents the side of Afghanistan that we never bothered to understand and that we also led to massive miscalculations on the Western world side, which was understanding their culture and their pride, right? So it's really a document designed to present to the West and be Western facing. But I did find that there was a huge expat community of Afghans who found out about the book, like, they're super well networked and were into it and were like buying copies and coming to signings. And that wasn't the goal, that wasn't the expected outcome, but it was really enjoyable because I was like, okay,
sure,
this is actually something that the Afghan community has wanted for a long time, to be presented outside of the context of just like poverty, homelessness, civil war, destitution, religious conflict, right? Like, I didn't realize how much that weighed on them, but, you know, everywhere,
anti-women rights.
Yeah, like, you know, just someone to speak about their culture outside of conflict, right? That was really gratifying. That's been a good part of it, and I'm working on like a little U.S. tour with the book. We've done Europe now, so I'm looking forward to like doing something in L.A., San Francisco, definitely New York, and I hope D.C.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's kind of that's the plans for the book.
Is there where can we put a link in the bio here for it? Is there someplace we can find Afghan style by Robert Spengler?
So my publisher, which is in the English pronunciation, because they're French, would be Editions Odyssey, but it's Editions Odyssey. Their website has the book. I'm sold out of books. I have a few special editions which each come with a print from the book, and also come with an artifact from the trip, so like a passport page or a film negative or one of my field note pages. So if you want a special edition, you can still get it from me. Those ship free. My publisher has the standard copies as well as I think a few of the special editions. And I will have more of my own copies, and I do have a little reserve that I'm going to take with me when I travel around the country doing the book tour. So chances are, if you're interested, I'm coming to your town and I will try not to burn it down.
No, do it. Come down. Come to Salt Lake City, bro. You come
I really want to do Salt Lake City. You know, a good, like, if anyone's out there and you've got, you know, a bookshop or a connection to one and you want to do like
a bookshop like Sam Weller's. Let me give him a plug. Okay. Weller's is a mom and pop shop in Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay.
Right. Amazing.
Like, that's the kind of thing I'm looking for, because because I've already described sort of my personal goal of the book, but my outward goal is I want to bring this book to as many Americans as I possibly can. That's really who it's designed for. And I find like the person-to-person interaction of being there with the book, to be able to explain it to people and talk about each image, that's super gratifying.
So, like, super cool too.
Salt Lake City, like any city, and yes, if you've got a bookstore that is interested in hosting something like this, like, I'm all about it. I'd love to do it. That is the final goal of the book.
Well, that's awesome. And I think that we can wind this down. We've been going at it, and I could keep talking to you.
Oh, man, we could be here all day.
We really could. But I think the commander at the 505th Airborne 82nd Infantry Division might have to go home right now, who listens. He wrote me a letter saying, Rad, I listen every single week to your show. I want to thank you. Something like that. And I want to say, what's up? Shout out to the, I think it's the 505th. What's up, bro? Parachute Regiment.
That's pretty cool.
Honorary Colonel.
I'm one of the rare airborne Marines. So I'm in favor of letting this guy go home. And
you got your gold wings or do you have just silver wings?
I got gold wings.
So you did all the different jumps.
Yeah. So my team within Force Recon was we were the static line jump team because we were the junior guys. But we're all gold wing qualified. And then I actually went out with an outfit as a civilian called World War II ADT, World War II Airborne Demonstration Team. And they jump out of World War II C-47s. So I jumped with them.
So
I also
cool.
got my army, actual like army issue wings from them. So
yeah, the silver jump
kind
wings.
Of cool, cool. Yeah. I got
well, airborne. That's the thing my dad always say. He'd say, you're a leg, but you're my leg, son. And I was like, all right, dad, thanks. And with that said, giving dad a shout out and mom, I just want to say thanks again, Robert, for taking the time out of your busy day and your book and everything that you're doing with designing to be on the show with Soft Rep. And thanks to my listener for taking the time to listen to the show. And I hope that something hits you in the feels, you know, and we should be supporting good and not evil in this world. And we should be able to have conversations with one another without, I hope you just saw what we just had, a conversation with one another.
Yeah.
So
all about it.
All about it. And Robert, I hope to see you soon, if not at SHOT Show or someplace very soon in Salt Lake City.
I gotta get back. Yeah.
I'll be there next time as well, covering for Soft Rep. So we'll link up for sure. And my man, I'm gonna wind it down and say on behalf of everybody here at Soft Rep, my guest Robert Spangle, 1000 Yard Style on Instagram. My name is Rad. I'm your host. Go check out the merch shop, the book club, and thanks again, Brandon, and everybody at Soft Rep.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.